Morning, members. Thank you for your patience. Sorry for the late start. We just actually had a late start because we've got so much on the agenda. We got to make sure we're organized. Representative Neuberger, let's do you first. I'm sorry, we need to do the minutes. Representative Green, do you want to move the minutes of March 30th?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes.
Okay. Discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. Thank you, members. Representative Neuberger, let's do your 3261 first. And then, Representative Neuberger, you're going to have an oral amendment. And does Ms. Taylor have the oral amendment yet, or is she still working? Or you? She has it. It has to do, members, and I talked to Representative Hansen, has to do that we would not... include school trust land in this amendment because that may be unconstitutional to include them. So should I just have Ms. Taylor? We haven't moved the bill yet. Representative Neuberger, do you want to move House File 3261 to be laid over, I believe?
Yes, Mr. Chair. That's my intention, to move House File 3261 to be laid over. And then also, do we need to move the amendment first to get this?
Yes. Representative Neuberger moves the DE3, and subject to the oral amendment that Ms. Taylor will tell us what that says. Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, it would be on the DE3 amendment on line 1.7, after section, insert, or work on school trust lands. And then I was also aware of another amendment addressing a different issue. That would be on line 1.11, after local citizens, insert, and other stakeholders.
Representative Neuberger is nodding. Yes. Representative Hans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We would support those corrections to get it into the proper format. I think I agree with Representative Neuberger. I kind of like local citizen involvement. Sometimes stakeholders aren't the local citizens, so as long as the local citizens are still involved rather than just the interests, I think that's important.
Okay, thank you. To the Neuberger amendment, DE3 as orally modified. No discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Representative Neuberger, you now have your bill before you as amended. Go ahead with your testimony. And Representative Neuberger, I know you're a little bit under the weather and we're kind of on a time crunch. We dilly-dallied the last couple of days, so now it's getting to the end of the week, so we got to rock and roll. Go ahead, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm here today to bring up a situation that deals with the Sand Dunes State Forest. The Sand Dunes State Forest is a unique situation, in my opinion. What we have here is an old forest, but we also have an old community that is part of it. If you just think about a weave on a basket, you have state forest land and then you've got private property. It's one big interwoven area. And what has happened here is we have people that live right next to these state forests and in and about the state forest. And what we've had happen here is that there's been a progressive clear-cutting policy that has been taking place. And what we're trying to do here, members, is try to have a little take a break here and stop things because the clear-cutting is extensive. I just have one picture here. I decided I'd save a tree, and I'll pass this around. But this. That's just one picture of many that kind of demonstrates what the people that live in and around the state forest have to look at as the clear cutting goes through. So what we're trying to do, members, is just put together a program here in this bill so that the DNR and the local citizens work together to come up with a plan as far as the clear cutting is concerned. And with that, Mr. Chair, I do have a couple of testifiers.
Why don't they come forward and you could identify yourself, and if there's anybody that you represent, that would be great. Thank you.
My name is Bob Quady. I'm working with a work group around the Sand Dunes State Forest. I was a 34-year employee of the Department of Natural Resources and Forestry, retired. Retired 3 years ago, and since then I've been working with this group to try to figure out some of the issues that are in the Sand Dunes State Forest. I've got a thing here I got to get rolling.
It's all right. Take your time.
Sand Dunes State Forest is a 6,000 acre forest in Sherburne County. To the north of it is 30,000 acres of federal refuge. The federal refuge is open as open landscapes, and part of the concern in the we have four issues. Part of the concern is the conversion of the forest to this open landscape. There's a plan to take half the forest and a maturing forest and convert it to oak savanna, grasslands, woodlands. Another concern is clear cutting. We're going to touch a little bit on that. Another concern is school trust land issues. We're not going to deal with, can't get into that today. Time is short. And the last one is a road funding concern from the townships. I'm also not going to be able to get into that today. This is the state forest. It's broken into two sections. The north section is, we call it the North Forest. The red on, it's an infrared photo, so the dark red is pine, conifers. The dark, the real dark is lakes there. And then there's the south part of the state forest. The conversion is pretty much that whole south piece of the state forest is going to be converted from forest to open landscape. As Jim mentioned, this is an intertwining of all around the perimeter of the forest is residents that live there and have gotten used to the look of the forest. Uh-oh. This is what an open landscape looks like. This is the refuge looking to the north. Kind of grasslands, brushlands intermixed with trees. This is currently what the forest looks like. It's a maturing white pine oak mixed forest. This is one of the stands that is in the conversion to be clear cut, an immature white pine stand with white pine coming in the understory. This is the campground that the plan shows. They're going to remove the conifers out of the campground and go to oak and native plant species in there. This is a stand that we interplanted with money for the White Pine Initiative. We were supposed to increase the amount of white pine on the land. It's a little bit hard to see, but this is a mixed, it was an oak clear cut. The intent was to start to intermix white pine in there so future we could move away from clear cuts and we would have a white pine oak forest we could use for thinning and kind of move away from the clear cut issue and do a multi-age thinning in the white pine. This is what we would, the forestry was moving to have the forest look like in the future. This is about a 20-year-old clear cut. It was oak wilt. The oak came back. We interplanted white pine, and you can see, hopefully, the kind of mix of oak and pine in that forest. This is an area that was planted with funds that is going to be converted to grasslands. Those are about 10-foot tall trees in there planted with taxpayer money. You'll hear talk about the need to go to this is because there's these threatened and endangered habitats, globally threatened. This is the old Auroch dump site. This is an old field, so not all these conversions are these threatened and endangered habitats that I suspect you'll eventually hear about. Clear cutting, there's four things. Why so much now? We have a regular forest management going on. When the forests mature or there's a disease issue, forestry commonly went in, harvested those, and then would reforest it. So that's still going on. But there's increased planting and increased harvest due to trust obligations, so that's adding on to that what we normally did in the past. Part of these forests are being converted, so that's added on before their rotation age. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is also right adjacent to the forest doing conversion as well through clear cutting. And components 3 and 4 have a Lessard's component to them that we've met with the committee and expressed our concerns about. This clear cut that was done was a 35-acre stand. Normally, if forestry was to manage that, that would have been left for another 3 to 4 decades before that was cut. That site is going to be converted back to open landscape, grasslands, prairie, whatever. So this is some of what the people are seeing out there before it's really needed because of age or illness. And this is why we appreciate Jim's efforts. The DNR mission statement talks about the DNR's mission is to work with the citizens. The word with implies an active interaction with more so than here's our plan, and here's why we're doing it. We understand that. Now we want to have some input into that plan, so we think this bill will help us do that. Also, the forest lands are certified lands. One of the certifying principles require them to give locals opportunities to interact with plans, have appeal processes. So this bill will also kind of help us along those lines.
And thank you. Appreciate it, Mr. Quay. Thanks for being brief and yet be very informative. We appreciate that. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for the testimony. I'm curious, how old are the trees that are being clear-cutted?
Mr. Quay.
Chairman, committee, right now, oak lived about 80 to 90 years before they mature and they start dying. Oak wilt issue comes in, so you almost have to clear-cut oak in order to get regenerated stump sprouts. Pine, we were going to rotate it from 80 to 100 years. The new recommendations are 60 to 70 years because of some trust concerns, so they're lowering that rotation age. This rotation in this subsection plan, there was 6 acres in the Anoka Sand Plain. By lowering that, you've gone up to almost 700 acres on 2,400. So you went from 0.3% to 30% eligible to be clear-cut with this new shifting of the rotation age in our area, because so much of it was planted during those CC, 70 years ago.
I think, Mr. Quaid, Representative Johnson's question surrounded around what were some of the ages if some trees in some people's mind were prematurely cut. What were some of the various ages of the pines that got cut? Arguably, you mentioned the ones were taken 20 to 30 years in the one photo. I thought you might also mention there was some 10-year-old pines cut down.
Yep. I'm getting back up to it. That was that stand we cut. They cut to, they were growing, maturing. They cut those to burn that back to open landscapes.
What age were those trees?
10, 12 years.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. It seemed, but basically, am I to understand, basically they proposed to cut 60 to 70-year-old trees, right?
Mr. Quay.
Chairman, if they go to maturity, they would be cutting the pine at 60 to 70 years, yes.
Thank you. And we will have DNR come down to additional questions. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to let you know I have to go because the governor is going to be visiting a school in South St. Paul. So Representative Hornstein's in charge on our side.
My classmate, Representative Hornstein, and I will do just fine. Thank you for letting us know. See no other questions. I'm sorry, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is going to be for DNR when they come down. But this comes back to me. This is a common theme. What we're asking for, what the people are asking for, there is for state agency, in this case the DNR, to work with local people. And if you were around here last week, that was a pretty common theme. And I'm interested to hear the rest of the conversation that we have. But Mr. Quaid, I'm curious to know the pine you're talking about, what specific type of pine is that?
Mr. Quaid.
Typically in the past we planted the red pine, but now we've been shifting to white pine. It can be managed as a multi-age species. In the mid-90s, the legislature pushed a white pine initiative and the citizens pushed it because they wanted to increase the amount of white pine. So we've been shifting more to white pine. It can be managed at multi-age level and thinned as opposed to clear cutting, which is red pine's more required to be clear cut.
Thank you. I think we have one more citizen, Representative Eklund. And then is there a Ron and Judy Gertz, is it? I think you could go ahead and come down after we take Representative Eklund's question. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one question for you. What was this forest originally? It's planted in pine, I get that. What was the original makeup of the forest back before the CCC days?
Mr. Quaid.
The forest was created in 1943 because it had been farmed in ag lands, pasture lands, and it started blowing around during the Dust Bowl days. The forest started with Section 16 and 36 and was added onto those. That's why you have the two blocks, and then it was planted to pine. So it was basically worn-out ag lands that they were planting.
Good question, Representative. Follow-up? No. Okay. Mr. and Mrs. Kurtz, do you want to come down? Yeah. Thank you.
You need to set your...
Yeah. first.
Welcome to the committee. If you could give us your name for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name is Ron Gertz.
Good morning.
I'm a resident of the Sand Dunes. A little write-up here that I wanted to present. So in September of 2014, we received our DNR notification that changes were coming to the Sand Dunes State Forest. I wasn't initially concerned because the letter said that a large portion of the forest would see no major changes in management approach and the areas being converted would be a slow process, taking 70 years or more. I can live with slow change. The DNR has done a great job of creating a beautiful environment out of a man-made disaster area. Why shouldn't they be trusted to continue? But in May of 2015, newspaper articles started alerting us to the fact that changes were coming fast. The red pines, planted in the 1940s to stabilize the sands that were blowing through the roads and into the people's homes, were now going to be managed to maximize revenue rather than timber volume. This means clear-cutting the pines at an age of 60 to 70 years instead of the prior age of 100 years plus. This major management change was done with an internal memo, no public input or notice. A large portion of the pines in the sand dunes that were planted to stabilize the sand dunes are at that age to fit the new criteria for final harvest. Let's spend the next 40 years transitioning into a multi-aged white pine forest that can be selectively harvested into the future without a need for clear cutting. Now, some areas of the open landscape conversion area have already been clear cut, and more logging bids are scheduled for this fall. This type of landscape is dependent on frequent burning to maintain the prairie, and I noticed that bare sand dunes is one of the features of the conversions that they find very desirable after decades of us citizens working to stabilize the sands. Air and water pollution caused by deforestation, burning, and the use of herbicides is a global problem that we hear about daily. I don't think our DNR should be promoting such activities on us, the 3,000 residents of the sand dunes, and certainly would not without any public involvement. I believe that management of the state land is predicated on not contributing to climate change. Let's maximize the carbon capture in the forests of the sand dunes. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Does your significant other have anything to add? If you do, if you could give us your name for that.
He has a feminine perspective, yes.
Good deal. We're glad to hear it. Welcome. Good morning. Please identify yourself for the record. Go ahead with your brief testimony.
I'm Judy Gertz. Well, in the beautiful Sand Dunes State Forest, it's 50 miles northwest of the metro area. I have lived there for 42 and a half years up against this beautiful forest. I've watched the beautiful pine trees grow through all four seasons. In our long Minnesota winters, evergreens are the only green we see. They are especially beautiful in the winter when they sparkle with the snow that can uplift your spirit. Forests are so important to humans and the earth that the UN has 21 reasons, which is in the computer, internet, why forests are important. March 21st is the International Day of Forest, a UN holiday highlighting the value of trees and the forest price of deforestation. So here in the sand dunes, state forest deforestation is being exchanged for prairies with rare species. Prairies seem to be trending. It seems to be a trend now. But why cut forest land over a trend? I don't mind a few acres of prairies, and I don't mind the thinning of the forest because that's good for forests. But the federal land, which is very close to the sand dunes, has 30,000 acres and that's mostly in prairies. I think enough is enough. I have been a realtor for 30 years and also an appraiser. And not once have I had a client say, find me a home with no trees because I want to live by a prairie. Because trees add property value. With all due respect to the DNR, their paperwork says they want to be good neighbors. So I want to hold them to that so I can feel secure as a resident of the sand dunes that someday, when I least expect it, I don't have to look out my window and the forest is gone. More importance has been put on prairies with rare species than the 3,000 people that live in Orrock Township, plus people that come here. Not only the people that live here, they come here to horseback ride, snowmobile, camp, swim, hunt, hike. People and myself love the visual quality of the forest with all its benefits to humans and the earth.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate both of you coming forward. Mr. Brandt, you want to come down? Thank you. I don't see any questions. Thanks a lot for driving down this morning. Next, we'll hear from Mr. Brandt with the forest industry and timber producers. Maybe you can just give us a real brief, Mr. Brandt, based on the current amendment that we have before us.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Please identify. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wayne Brandt with Minnesota Forest Industries, Minnesota Timber Producers Association. Appreciate the opportunity to make a few comments this morning. I'd like to thank Representative Neuberger for the amendment, which I think puts the bill in a much better shape, resolves a number of the concerns that we had. We certainly understand the concerns of the neighbors in the area, particularly as it relates to the conversion of pine acreage and mixed pine forest to oak savanna. I would note that, you know, we would not consider that a traditional form of forest management. You know, our members use oak from the southeast forest and other places, but also pine very substantially. So we share many of the concerns that the neighbors have expressed regarding this conversion. You know, we do have a few remaining concerns as the language goes forward. You know, some concerns on the short-term impact on timber supply. We appreciate that the amendment does not preclude traditional pine management, as has been described, you know, thinnings, regeneration back to pine, those types of harvest and management. You know, we think that the citizens, it certainly sounds like, have been supportive of that in the past, and, you know, we would look forward to that kind of management in the future. We also appreciate that it doesn't impact existing contracts that are out there. So we would like to continue to work with the author and the department, you know, on the issue and hopefully have a positive resolution for all concerned.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Brandt. Mr. Meyer, do you want to come down and confirm where the department's at and see if there, I think there was at least a question from Representative Fabian, but maybe first if you have some comments. Welcome, Commissioner. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. And first of all, I want to thank Representative Neuberger for working with us on this important issue. And also apologize. If we would have done a better job working with our public input process in the beginning, we probably wouldn't be here today. And there was a meeting on Monday where we reinitiated that process that Mr. Quady set up. And we are committed to working with the citizens as this language does. With or without this language, we're going to work with the citizens in the area and other interested people to develop a plan and to implement processes in the management of this land. So I just want to echo that. And we do take very seriously our public input process, as we spoke last night in Representative Hackbarth's committee. We are discussing changes and how do we take that public input and process more seriously. So the bill that's before you today, we can support. We're working with the author on it. You'll see a map that's coming around that shows our management activities.
there was some prescribed burning that we were talking about doing some invasive species work, and this allows existing timber management to go on. The department does have concerns about talking about clear cutting. You know, it's really not clear cutting. It's silvicultural practices we're talking about, and some of it is a conversion that we'll work with the local citizens and other people to figure out how do we do that to protect the rare species that are there, but also to protect the forest for the future. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, you know, we'll work with the committee and the author on this bill as it moves forward. I think it's pretty close to the shape that we can support. We support it right now. It's just dealing with the term clear cutting in statute is something that is concerning to the department. So we can deal with that as this moves forward. I can answer any question.
Well, Commissioner, I appreciate that, and I was nervous about that myself because clear cutting is a practice that many of us support. It's the final clearing of the land after maybe it's been through a rotational thinning or whatever has been the situation, but it is a normal practice. And I think the most important thing is you coming forward and acknowledging we need to take a deep breath. I understand where Mr. Brandt's at, that he's a little nervous, taking a deep breath at this time and understand that there's some difference of opinion within DNR itself between forestry and eco and waters and how this is being managed. Where I'm coming from, this is a state forest, and it should be managed as a state forest, and we have sustainable forestry initiatives that allow for the protection of the Dakota Skipper and things like that within a state forest. And I just want to make sure that if some of this needs to be designated different, to be managed different, but it is a state forest. And so thank you for working with Representative Neuberger, who was doing the right thing and bringing forward an issue that his constituents. And thank you, Mr. Quaid, as a former DNR employee. I appreciate your involvement in continuing to work. And I will tell you, sometimes we hear from disgruntled state employees and they don't have the best relationship with the departments they used to be at. And as a son of a former state employee for a number of years, that was not what I heard about you. There was nothing but praise for the work you did as a DNR forestry, and that helps us a lot. So thank you for continuing to be involved. Commissioner Meyer, thank you for finding a solution. Representative Neuberger, thank you for working on your constituents' behalf to do the right thing. We have a couple of questions, and then we do have two other bills. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, I'm curious, as Chair McNamara says, this is a state forest, and forestry is an important part of the DNR and the state for that matter. But I just can't help but ask, I don't believe that the Division of Forestry is the originator of this conversion within your agency. I'm curious to know, from within the agency, where does this conversion come from, away from a forest to a prairie?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, the department is a diverse agency, right? We're made up of divisions that form a cohesive act unit, right? So forestry, ecological water resources, fish and wildlife, enforcement, we all work together and we all try to develop and protect the resources of the state as an agency. So looking at the unit, as Representative McNamara, Mr. Chair, talked about, the state forest, where do we go in the future? And we also have our forestry certification process that requires us to set aside some of these rare and unique habitats and provide these different types of habitats. So looking at this landscape and the future of the landscape is where the decision came from, that was brought together as a department, not by any one division. So I understand your concerns, but we're working as the Department of Natural Resources to manage the state land in the best possible management.
Representative Fabian.
Commissioner Meyer, I appreciate your answer, but I'm still asking the question. From within the agency, where did this originate?
Mr. Chairman,
I appreciate that you're working together, but I want to know specifically within the agency, where did this initiative come from?
These management plans came from a cross-divisional meeting process that we have. It's called SFRMP, looking at the management of these lands and trying to figure out where do we go as a state in providing habitat throughout the state.
Representative.
And forest work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in those meetings that you have where you have these cross-management things, who initiated the conversation within that to convert the forest to prairie?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, it began at the regional level, so region, central region discussions, and that was brought forward to the department at that level.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And at the regional level, which division or agency within the regional level started these conversations of conversion?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, it was brought about by discussions with Ecological Water Resources and the Division of Forestry together.
Thank you.
Fabian. Thank you. Representative Hugel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, I have a question about the health impact assessment part of things here. Do you normally conduct those types of assessments? And if you do, how are they done?
Representative Uglum, what document are you looking at? Where are you at?
I believe right here in 3261.
You got to look at the
DE. The DE is out then, huh? That's out.
Representative Uglum, why don't you take a deep breath, look at what you have. Representative Clark. I'm sorry, Representative Johnson, I bet it is. Representative Clark, was it you? Did you have...
I did.
I've been going back and forth between Representative Clark Johnson and Representative.
You know, you're not the only one, Mr. Chair.
And
it's okay.
It was written down. Sometimes we write the first name on the list, and sometimes.
Well, I'm honored either way.
Assistant wrote your last name, Representative Clark.
Thank you. I was just double checking, and I have to apologize to you and others. I'm late coming in, so. But I remember there was. This isn't the one that had the potential of growing potatoes on that land, was it? This is not that one. Okay. Just was trying to make sure, because there was another part where they were cutting down the woods to do potatoes, I recall.
We're a couple hundred miles away from that one. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Somewhat similar landscape, though. Next, I have Representative Uglum. Did you have... You're good. Okay, Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason I asked originally what the original landscape was before this was planted is back in the early 2000s, I worked on a national level on a national forest landscape plan, and the citizens out west especially had similar concerns to what your constituents have, Representative Neuberger. And what happened is a lot of people moved into the national forest in and adjoining to it, and then did not want any cutting going on because they liked their trees and they liked their mountains, and which I do too. But then the forest fires came, and all of a sudden, the homeowners were after the federal government to do something to protect their homes, and I get that too. So that's why I asked that question. But just a couple comments other than that is 5% is not a clear cut. Where I live, we have clear cuts, and I've heard from several logging interests since this bill was introduced that they're concerned that by doing this, and I certainly understand you working with your constituents, that's, I applaud that, but that we might start a slippery slope on clear cuts, and in northern Minnesota, if we can't clear cut timber, we can't supply timber to the manufacturers that need it. So I've got concerns about that. And then my final comment on this is, you know, silviculture and best management practices are well established, and so I just want to be cautious about how we go about this. And then I am real concerned about converting a productive forest into a something that is not productive for the citizens of the state. So there's a lot of stuff all tied into that, but the number one thing is I'm real concerned about where we're going with this whole clear-cut issue. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Eklund. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick observation, if you will, and thank you for the work being done on this. I recollect, I don't know, 2 weeks ago now, we were sitting here talking about some timber harvest up close to my district where we're talking about potlatch lands and going to take the timber out and convert it to potatoes. And I remember Representative Hugin giving me some grief, I think, about the size of our lumber mill up there. And I'm glad to hear that we value forest. And we had the deer hunters sitting here talking about the value of forest and habitat. So this is refreshing to hear this all over again, and we can manage this forest in a good way. I mean, there's a way to make everybody happy, I believe. We do clear cut up our way. And that language was scary for us. So thank you for moving that out.
Thank you. Representative Neuberger, any final comments?
Mr. Chair, members, I want to thank you for your time and just to encourage your support.
Thank you, Representative Neuberger. House File 3261 is laid over. Members, next I'd like to bring forward House File 2866. Mr. Meyer, you might as well just stay there. We'll let Forrester Quaid get his computer wrapped up there. Members, I'd like to move House File 2861 to the General Register. House File 2866 to the General Register. And we have an amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. And is this the, this is the prescribed burn. You know what? And then it's also the Neuberger Amendment. Let's see. How about, Representative Hornstein, how about if we move the A5 to get the bill in the shape the author would like?
That would be great.
Yeah. And thank you. And I guess we have an oral amendment. Oh, that's right. The same one, I would imagine. Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, on the A5, we'll want to make the corresponding changes to the language we just heard. So on line 2.19, after section, insert or work on school trust lands. And then on line 2.23, after citizens, insert and other stakeholders.
Okay, thank you. Discussion to the modified, orally modified A5. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The A5 is adopted. Do we have one more?
A2?
Representative Hackbarth, Representative Hackbarth, will you speak to the A2?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'll move the A2 amendment. I was in consultation with a number of different folks on the language that's in your bill. And we're going to tweak it a little bit, and it's a little more acceptable. I believe the DNR is agreeable as well.
And Representative Hackbarth, this deals with allowing Native Americans to rice without requiring them to buy the state rice.
Exactly.
And this was clarifying what we were accomplishing there. Let's go to Representative Clark and then Commissioner Meyer. Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, and who's the author of the amendment? Representative Hackbarth?
Representative Hackbarth is the author of the amendment.
Okay, so if I'm not mistaken, I think this was opposed by the tribal members who were here when we had this bill. Isn't that right?
Representative Hackbarth.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, I believe they were in agreement with the language that's in the bill. This is just tweaking the
local. Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Clark. She's picking the lighter.
They weren't in agreement. They spoke against the bill, but this has, and I thought it was also this kind of amendment that we had then. Am I right?
No, Representative Clark, this issue hasn't been before the committee, and I'm not aware. Representative Purcell, are you aware of, I thought, as far as I know, the Native American, let's let Commissioner Myers got the answer. Commissioner Myers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, I believe you are thinking of an issue that was before this committee dealing with the Lasart Sam Doctor Heritage Council bill and the White Earth Band on an acquisition proposal. This amendment actually amends our language that would allow tribal members to harvest wild rice within the state of Minnesota without purchasing a state license. Currently, they're required to purchase a state license if they're on state property. So we're trying to do something positive for the band.
Mr. Chairman, I stand corrected. I'm very happy that we have this before us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hackbarth moves the A2. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The A2 is adopted. I think we now have the bill before us. Commissioner Meyer, are you going to explain, walk through the whole bill, and then I don't know if you need Assistant Director Schmidt. You can do the part about there is a little bit of a tweak from the prescribed burn bill that's incorporated in here, and maybe you could just touch on, or I don't know if you need the Assistant Director to touch on that week when you get to that part, or do it at the end, whatever works. Commissioner Meyer,
Mr. Chairman, let's discuss that language at the end, and I'll do a walk through the bill to try to keep your committee on track here. So this is the department's policy and technical bill. Thank you for working with us and carrying this bill for us. And really, the major policy thing, if you want to call it, we already discussed, dealing with the tribal harvest ricing license. I'll just walk through section by section. There's a number of sections in the beginning of the bill that were changing listed back to designated or designated back to listed.
dealing with invasive species. We had a bill last year that changed these terms, and some terms got changed inadvertently. So you'll see Section 1, we're striking listed, returning to designated as by rule for non-indigenous species. Section 2, we're doing the same thing, changing list to designated, dealing with prohibited invasive species, and then listing infested waters. Section 3 of the bill, we're changing list to designate prohibited invasive species again, dealing with our rulemaking for the hunting and fishing seasons. Section 4 was amended just now, so we just talked about that, dealing with the tribal rice harvesting. Section 5 is some language that we actually worked with Representative Hackbarth and Representative Fabian, trying to get our arms around the starry stonewort issue, dealing with algae. It's actually an invasive algae, and we've changed it to a macro algae, so people who have boats moored on Lake of the Woods, for example, don't have to scrub or decontaminate the slime, as was the technical term we were talking about, off of their boats. Section 6 of the bill is actually clarifying that a person cannot legally have in their possession, say, a boat anchor covered with zebra mussels as a souvenir. So we want to just get rid of that stuff out there and make sure that we have control of all those invasive species issues that are there. Section 7 deals with a definition change coming out of a situation that we needed to clarify in the courts, that a law relating to non-native species, aquatic plant or aquatic macrophytes applies in the same manner, whether it's dead or alive. So even if these plants may be dead, for example, spiny water flea can live for a long time if it's just out of the water, so we want to make sure that we're clarifying that. Section 8 gets into a situation where we're setting up a pilot project that will allow us to gain more information and implement a process, hopefully, where riparian landowners, if you have a boat, for example, at your cabin, right now it's against the law to take it to an off-site storage facility unless it's fully decontaminated. So what we're doing is, in Lake Minnetonka, there are boat storage facilities, or lake service providers, we call them, who put in docks, who put in irrigation systems, things like that, who have an advantage over some others because they have storage facilities that are associated on the shore of the lake. This will set up a process for us to evaluate where a lake service provider can take your boat, haul it to their pole barn that might be 5 miles away in a secure chain of custody, and bring it back to that same lake that next spring. So there's areas of the state, Representative Eklund's district, all of your districts where you have boat storage facilities that are off riparian lands, that hopefully we can get to someday, develop a process whereby we can make sure that boat comes off of that infested water and then comes back to that infested water without causing further further contaminations. So that you'll see that language in Section 8. Section 9 of the bill also allows for that process to take place, where we're talking about transporting water-related equipment. Section 10 actually outlines the Lake Minnetonka pilot study that I was talking about there, and we'll be coming back to report to the legislature on that issue. Section 11 also is related to that piece of it, allowing us to issue a permit for that transportation. Section 12 is actually a piece that we've worked with the Civil Law Committee, changing a criminal citation to a civil citation for these provisions: failure to comply with the decontamination order, failure to decontaminate, or failure to complete the aquatic invasive species screening if you do get a violation. So we're actually making it, I don't want to say it, but simpler for somebody. We can just give them a ticket rather than have them go to court for these violations. Section 13 clarifies that as well, puts those citations, the penalties, in law. Section 14 deals with the Mississippi River Critical Corridor area, and we talked about this within the State and Local Government Committee. This allows us to establish by expedited rule, the process where these communities, basically runs from Dayton down to Denmark Township, where these communities will be able to update their ordinances administratively more efficient than the process is right now, updating their comprehensive plans. The League of Minnesota Cities does support this language, and it just allows us to establish through expedited rule, clarifying the administrative process at the end of the rulemaking piece. Section 15 talks about the report on our feasibility study, and Mr. Chairman, that is the bill without the two amendments, and we can discuss, if you wish, the prescribed burn piece at this point in time.
Thank you, Commissioner Meyer, and I don't think Assistant Director Schmidt needs to come down on the prescribed burns. It was, we eliminated a couple technical.
Mr. Chairman, we do support the amendment that you presented.
Added the word equipment. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, thank you. Back to Section 5 on page 3. I just want to be clear that we are addressing the issue of boats that are moored in a harbor, you know, particularly for in my district on Lake of the Woods. They sit there all summer and they get that slime or scum on them. I just want to make sure that that's not, that we are addressing the issue as we discussed about cleaning and transporting and all that. That's what
Mr.
This
Chairman,
is.
Representative Fabian, yes, the term macroalgae does cover that.
Yep, thank you.
Commissioner Meyer, I misspoke a little bit. Representative Hackbarth, on my A5 amendment, your issue is on page 2, line 10. I want to direct Representative Hackbarth, when the bill was before us before, asked about the normal agricultural practices not be part of that prescribed burn, and I wanted to make members aware that that's been added in. Thank you. Representative Hackbarth is acknowledging yes to that. Is there any more discussion on House File 2866? Seeing none, is there any public wants to testify for or against the bill? House File 2866, the DNR's policy bill. Anyone in the audience? Seeing none, all those in favor of House File 2866 onto the General Register, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. House File 2866 is out of the committee onto the General Register. We have one more bill before us today, members. It's House File 3715. It's a Fabian bill. We'll give a couple seconds here to get organized. Representative Fabian, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to lay it over to Representative Fabian.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3715, and then I have the A1 amendment.
Representative Fabian would move House File 3715 to be laid over. He has the A1 to get the bill in the shape he would like to the A1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
The amendment's adopted, and it's in the shape the author would like. Representative Fabian, to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, when I started discussions with some local officials with regards to demo landfills, I knew as much about a demo landfill as hogs do about Sunday school, but I've been educated quite a bit here in the last few months. The issue before us has to do with permitting of demo landfills, in this case, Class 1 landfills. The small landfills that are demolition landfills throughout the state of Minnesota, there's roughly 60, 65 of them in the state. And the issue centers around the re-permitting and getting the permits issued in a timely manner so that they have some sort of regulatory certainty. We talked about that in this committee before. What I'm trying to do with this bill is to get the agency to basically follow the statutes, the rules, and the guidance documents that they currently have in place. And if there needs to be some rule changes and so forth in the future, involve the people who are impacted by this. I think that they've kind of strayed away from their mission at this point. There's a number of permits that have been applied for dating all the way back to 1999 that have not been acted on by the agency. And so what I'm attempting to do is to get the agency to come back to these people and work with them in a constructive and positive way. We are not asking for permits to pollute. You know, we all care about clean air, clean water, and clean land. But we also need to have some common sense and a willingness to work with local people on these issues. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn the over to my testifiers.
Welcome, Mayor, welcome back. But I think today you are probably here not as the mayor of Roseau, but as the director of environmental services for the county. So, director, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you're correct. My name is Jeff Pulowski. I'm finishing up my 27th year as the environmental services director for Roseau County, and The last 5 years, I've assumed the duties of both county coordinator and environmental services director. And yes, you're right. For some reason, they keep reelecting me as mayor of Roseau. I'm on my 18th year as the mayor up there, and I recognize a lot of you because of the help you've given us in our flood recovery efforts up in Roseau, and I'll say thanks for that. That's off the topic. But anyway, today I have my county hat on.
It doesn't hurt that you've got both leads of the capital investment here to hear you put that little plug in for your city. So
well,
now back
Representative
to the
Housen was very helpful to our efforts up in Roseau. So,
yep.
As this committee was, everything started here. So, yeah. And okay. So today, one of my duties with the county is administering our comprehensive solid waste management program, and we're really here today to point out the issue of the role that small demolition landfills, what they serve in our communities. And in our county, looks at, we have a small class one demolition landfill. We're the only one within 130 miles from Bedette to Hallock, and we operate it at a loss, but for a public service. And And I want to talk about, rather than talking about our facility in particular, because there are over 50 facilities in the state right now that permits have run out and are in the same situation, but just a brief backup history, and I'm trying to be brief here, but it's kind of a complicated issue. But back in 2004, the MPCA came with some rules to that in effect would have treated demolition landfills very similar to sanitary landfills and made it cost prohibitive to operate as a small, as a class one demolition debris facility. And so there was a pushback from the private and public sectors, and the outcome of that process, and the legislature was involved, it was a very contentious process, but the outcome was the development of the 2005 guidance document, which was put into place specifically to add clarity, because the rules are very ambiguous. There was no change in rules that have been on the books for years. But what it did is it created a guidance or a pathwork, a framework to move forward for the facilities and the agency as we were to go through the operating and re-permitting these facilities. Well, since that guidance document was put in place in 2005, we went through a repermitting in 2009, and it went very smoothly. There was give and take. It wasn't, there always is. It's never 100% great, but it was a process, and we knew what to expect up front, and we went through it. Well, now we're up for permit again, and Mike will talk about his facilities too, but now we're up in business as usual. We had submitted our permit application 6 months in advance of our expiration, which was June of 2014. And during the process, we were informed that, the guidance document is no longer valid. And we have a duty to protect groundwater, and we're seeing that demolition landfills around the state are polluting groundwater. And so basically the long and short of it, without going into all the grisly details, is thou shalt install a liner leachate collection system or close the door. Well, there isn't, like I said, we lose money every day operating, just starting up the cat and having staff on hand. There's no way that these private, for the amount of waste that we get, that we're going to be able to comply with that kind of a regulation. And again, it's more the process. We were not informed, and what had happened is the word started getting out as permittees like Fergus Falls and Roseau, and as our permits came due, we were getting the news. There was no upfront communication from the agency with the stakeholders saying, we're changing the rules, we're changing the playing field. Okay?
That there was none of that. It was just, oh, by the way. And so this is process related. And what we're asking today in this bill is that we're basically sending a message to the agency to back up. Okay, we're not asking for a license to pollute. We're asking for to be a part of the process to say, okay, first of all, we haven't adequately defined if demolition landfills are causing a groundwater problem. If they are, we want to be part of the solution. Okay, we can't right now the agency has said there is a problem and here's what we're going to do. And we're just saying take a step back, work with the stakeholders, use the guidance document in the interim so we can get these permits that are backlogged up and issued so we know what our future is and then move forward. And so that's all we're asking is that we work with the agency, that they work with us, and it appears, I know they'll probably testify later, but it appears, Mr. Chair and members, that they've verbally agreed to do this, is to step back and but I think that we'd all feel better as both private and public sector owners of these facilities if it was on the record that we had a path moving forward. And so like I said, rather than getting into the details of our individual facility, which we could if questions come up, that's kind of it in a nutshell is let's stick to a process and move forward.
Thank you, Director. Representative Fabian, no comments at this time. Mr. Hannon, if you could identify yourself for the record, it's your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Mike Hannon. I'm the Solid Waste Administrator in Otter Tail, Todd, and Wadena counties. Collectively, we own and operate 4 Class 1 demolition landfills in our 3 counties. In addition, in Otter Tail County, there's a publicly owned Class 1 demolition landfill that's owned by the city of Fergus Falls. Jeff alluded to that a little bit. And I think Jeff did a really good job of laying out some of our concerns and the process. Over the years, I've been around about the same amount of time as Jeff, maybe slightly longer. But over the years, you know, we've had these processes that have developed rules, developed guidance documents. In fact, I was around when the original 1988 rules were adopted, and that in itself was a huge process. And by the early 2000s, when we began looking at, you know, maybe needing to reevaluate those rules, it became pretty clear that we didn't have enough information at that time to actually look at redoing rules. So we ended up with the guidance document, and I don't think the agency staff really felt comfortable with that. I know the county staffs didn't really feel comfortable with it, but it seemed like the best step forward from that point was to come to some sort of understanding. And if you were to review the guidance document, it's pretty well laid out. It identifies where you can site a facility. The size of the facility kind of dictates whether you need groundwater monitoring, don't need groundwater monitoring, need liners, don't need liners, what types of materials you can take. It actually is a pretty well laid out document, and I credit the agency and all the other folks that worked on that. But when we got done with that and moved forward, you know, there were some expectations of where we would end up, and I think Jeff laid that out real well. You know, there was some discussions of this is a roadmap. This is how we're going to get from where we're at today to where we're going to be at tomorrow. And today now is tomorrow. From our perspective, I was invited to a meeting with the agency and the city of Fergus Falls in regard to their landfill repermitting process. And the city had submitted a permit application. We're all required to submit our applications 180 days prior to our existing permit expiring. We've all done that. In our 5 facilities in our 3 counties, 3 of those facilities are up for review right now. We all submit our permit documents, and in the case of Fergus Falls, which was the first one of those 3 to submit, you know, they submitted in October of 2014. Never really heard much from the agency until late 2015, and they received a a review letter, which was very short, a couple items. They invited me to the meeting. We sat down with the city and the agency, and lo and behold, it, as Jeff pointed out, it was kind of identified, well, you know, the permit document that you, application that you've submitted is inadequate because you're going to have to design liners and leachate collection systems, and it was kind of, where is all this coming from? And you know, I think Jeff did a real good job. You know, we've met, the agency has scheduled several meetings. We've met with the agency staff. We've really tried to impress upon them that while there is more data and information available today than there was in 2004 and 2005, there's been a lot of discussion about what exactly some of that data means, and we've asked the agency to take a step back. Let's take a look at it. Let's see, make sure we understand it, and then develop a set of rules, hopefully, not guidelines, that would move us forward from here into a process where we all know what to expect when we submit those permit applications. Because as you all may guess, you know, when we do those, we don't have staff in our small counties to prepare them. We go out and we hire a consulting firm, and we spend thousands of dollars preparing those. And when you're in the shoes of the city of Fergus Falls, who now is being told you have to resubmit your application after having done it once, that makes it real difficult for us. And again, we're thankful to Representative Fabian for meeting with us and bringing this forward, but we're really asking, you know, let's take a step back. Let's look at how we move from where we're at today. And I do think we're hearing some from the agency staff that that they're willing to take a look at it, but we really want that to be a directive. Thank you, members.
Thank you. Thank you both for your testimony. Any questions for either of the testifiers? Representative Horns.
Are we going to be hearing from the PCA?
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Well, I thought if there's no questions for the testifiers, if you guys could stick around, there could be questions for you as we hear. Mr. Benke or Commissioner Kadalka, Mr. Benke is going to come forward. And we'll hear from MPCA on their thoughts. Welcome, Director. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Benke. I'm the Director of the Resource Management Assistance Division at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. You can probably tell by the tint of my hair that I've been around as long as Mike and Jeff. I don't know what solid waste does to folks, but something like that. I think the issue at hand was summed up quite well by both of the testifiers earlier. We have a situation that has developed over time. Back in 2004, we developed guidance for demo landfills, and we thought we had a path forward. And it also included a way to look at those landfills. These were landfills without liners to take a certain type of material that we assumed that would have lesser impacts on groundwater and also serve as an opportunity locally to manage those materials. We put in place a monitoring network throughout the state, and when the results started to come back, we found that there was contamination that was starting to show up from these sites. Now, we haven't necessarily had the length of time we might want in order to have all the data points come in forever, but the trends that we're seeing had us concerned. And so as new facility applications came in for similar facilities in similar locations, we needed to make sure we were addressing the issues that were occurring before we added to the problem. We have a handout out that shows the demolition debris landfills throughout the state, and you can see there's one in nearly every county, several of them in some. And so adding more to that seemed difficult. We were also faced with the other problem, and that was how do we re-permit or reissue the permits to the existing facilities if there are problems that are associated with that. So some of the staff did get out and have some conversations on those re-permittings. And then we started hearing back from the applicants on the issues and different perspectives from necessarily from ours that we had. So we did meet with the operators group. It was an extended group up in St. Cloud back in August, and started down the road, I think, to a stakeholder involvement process. In the meantime, we've got to deal with the existing applications that are in. As was stated earlier, some of them are getting older in terms of being expired. We want to make sure we can update those, but also get them in a place where they can be operating the best that they can be. And also take into the considerations that we laid out in the guidance. There's distance, there's location, there's economic issues that we all have to balance in there. And so we've been trying to do that. I think the ability to take a look at the data, I think, is probably not a bad idea to make sure we're on the right track with that. But we also know that we've got issues that we will still need to manage at some of the sites and need, you know, I think, some assurance that we're going to do that. Landfill Operators Group hasn't said that they won't do that, and they haven't said that there isn't issues, but we need, I think, the time to do it, and I think it's probably a good suggestion that we take that time and work through the problem together, not separately. We have conducted those meetings to start with and thought we were on that path, but they are not easy answers to get to. There are perspectives that aren't necessarily shared, and we need to work through those to get to a solution together. So, and with that, I can answer any questions that you might have.
Well, thank you, Mr. Benke. And why don't we go to Representative Hornstein, and then I've got a few comments. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Benke. I was just reading your report, which is very good, that you distributed along with the map of the demolition landfills. And you had, you know, you write that the nature of the contamination ranges from occasional detections of chlorinated solvents to more frequent detections of inorganics, metals, boron, manganese, arsenic. You later go on to say that boron, manganese, and arsenic are commonly seen constituents down gradient at unlined Class 1 demolition landfills. And then you say some of the materials accepted are concrete made from coal ash, wallboard, and wood. Is there any thought to redirecting some of these problem materials? I mean, I think concrete made from coal ash, I mean, shouldn't, would you consider that going to a lined or a different kind of facility? Maybe some of the issues around, I mean, there's definitely issues about liners, and I agree that that's the direction that we need to go, but do you think some of these materials that are creating these very hazardous leachate components could be directed to other kinds of facilities?
Director Benke.
Mr. Chairman, members, we have worked with the facilities on three levels. First, the design of the facility to prevent things from happening. The second is the management of the types of materials that come in. And as you talk about, there are different constituents in the waste stream that we do want to direct to other places. Concrete for recycling, the rebar out of that concrete for recycling, those kind of things. And the last is the operational management of the site, how large a open face that they might have at a given time, how they manage the stormwater, how they manage, you know, just the different operation parts of that. And so all three of those are the factors that come in. It's not just lining the facilities. So I agree, and we have to come through with a way that blends all three of those as we move forward. But we also have an issue that, you know, even though there are red dots on this map, the sizes and volumes that each one of these facilities takes in is quite different. And so to try and get one size fits all for everything is a little bit difficult. And the guidance, I think, does take that into account. But when we have generalized about these facilities, it's a little hard to say we are, you know, getting it right when we do that, because we've got to look at them all a little bit more individually based on those factors.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. And Director Benke, how about does the department take into account the geographical distance sometimes that's involved here? And do you work with the operators to find a solution that works if say the demo landfill, the agency is beginning to think that maybe this is a potential, the ground underneath this landfill is one that might be susceptible to contamination for whatever. But just to say, you know what, we're going to close it and not have discussions looking forward as to what's the best solution. Because the reality, I wonder how much as we'd like to think it's all going into a demo landfill, how much of the concrete's going out in the back 40, and they're not worried whether it had coal ash in it or not. And if we close the only demolition landfill within 50 miles, they're going by 100 different fields on the way just to, you know, put it in the back 40 and not worry about it. I mean, sorry, that's the reality. That is PCA blind to that sometimes and not listening to these operators and work proactively? Maybe this isn't the best spot. We need to work with you. We can't have this operation ongoing. Is there a chance for it to be a drop-off site, and how would that work, and what are the logistics of doing that? Sometimes it seems like the department just says, no, you need to haul it somewhere else, when the reality, they're somewhere else. Might be dumping it over a little spot that it's unfortunately a trout stream right underneath it because nobody could see where they were or whatever. I think that's some of the frustration we hear out in the hitherland. Director Benke.
Mr. Chairman, that is certainly something that we need to make sure we include in that. And that's what one of the reasons we've included some of the other landfill operators from the metro area and the consultants to try and give us better ideas on what we might be able to do, recognizing that we've got current facilities that we need to work with and find that path forward. And it might be that we close up existing facilities and create a transfer station, as you've suggested, you know, getting a pad and some roll-off boxes there and creating a hub and spoke over the facility that might be most appropriate for that. But that probably can't happen overnight because we've got existing facilities and existing needs to happen. So we do have to make a longer-term plan for that rather than the short-term. So I definitely agree with you on making sure that that path forward includes the existing as well as what the future will look like.
And Director Benke, I drive by probably the biggest demo landfill. It's the hazardous waste one. It's everything, the SKB site, and I guess it's in Rosemont, but I drive by it every day on the way to work. That's different for us in the metro and our ability. I mean, hundreds of trucks are going in there every day. They open at 7, and when I'm going by, they are really going in there. Lots of what's special, and they've got the ability to micromanage exactly where that waste came from, how it was dumped, and they know everything about it to the T, and that's pretty cool that we can do that in the metro. I'm sorry, you can't do that in Representative Fabian or Representative Eklund's district. And in Representative Eklund's district, they dump it behind the woods because there's woods there. And in Representative Fabian's district, they dump it over the, well, you don't have many hills, but they dump it in some little ditch that sometimes, I mean, some people do. And I think, I know you have 900-plus employees in your agency that you work with, but be nimble and work with folks to do some of what we can do. And maybe we're making this transfer station too doggone elaborate in our design. And as you said, this is a little pad, and the water runs into a rainwater garden, and then they transfer it and let them operate it in an efficient manner instead of creating a bureaucracy that, you know, please be conscious of what's going on and bring that message back to the commissioner. Thank you. Representative Eklund, or did you have a comment? I mean, I'm just going on and on.
Mr. Chairman, I agree.
Thank you. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, we don't dump it in the woods. However, if you take a look at this map, if you remove two or three of those red dots across northern Minnesota, then it will be getting dumped in the woods. And I want to compliment Mr. Hainan and Mr. Pulowski, because I don't believe there's any people that work harder for their counties than our environmental service directors, and I know you work well with Dale Olson from Coochin County. Director Benke, in my question is, why did it take so long to pull the stakeholders together? Because I was board chair in Coochin County in 2014 when this first became to the county board, and you didn't have the stakeholder meeting till September, or I mean in St. Cloud till last summer. So it can't take that long to pull a meeting together.
Director Behnke.
Mr. Chair, members, I think in looking at our process, I think that was definitely an error on our part. I think pulling the stakeholder group back together earlier was something that we should have done. In addition, I think the guidance document also talked a little bit about getting the data and working through that earlier rather than later, and we have not done that. But, you know, letting, you know, that be the reason we don't meet was something that I thought shouldn't happen. And so as soon as we started seeing that, we discussed this with the landfill operators group, and they invited us to come and visit. And we had some, and continue to have, I think, some really good, robust discussions about what we need to do. And I think that's the path forward, to get people to talk about the perspectives and the needs and balance those so we can have the best protection we can for the state with these facilities.
Thank you. Representative Eklund.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. One final follow-up. The roll-off boxes that were mentioned, okay, Cushing County certainly currently hauls their municipal solid waste to Marquette landfill. We use roll-off boxes. That's the best that we can use. They are very costly, very spendy to maintain, and I can't imagine how they would work properly for demolition landfill. I think it would just be an increased cost to rural counties that it would not be a good path to go down for us. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Point well made. Representative Fabian, any closing comments? Representative Heinzman has asked that the FFA come down, so we want to give them a couple minutes to speak.
No, Mr. Chair, I think Representative Eklund made a good point in how hard these guys work back home to do the right thing. We all care about clean air, clean water, clean land, but we're also concerned about process, we're concerned about expenses. These guys run a tight ship in the Roseau demo landfill. If Markstrom Construction shows up with a roll-off and it's got a pop can in it, they're not getting the dump. They got to go and figure something else out. So they do a really good job under the rules and the regulations, the statutes, and the guidance documents that are in place. And I just want to make sure that the agency is not backing away from what I perceive to be a statement that they're willing to go and work with the people. And in the last closing, this is a source of great frustration for me. I have a map. You can take a look at it. The state of Minnesota owns a landfill immediately adjacent to our demo landfill. And it's been showing hits of, I think it's called vinyl chloride or whatever. I'm not sure what it is. In the water. This has been gone for many, many years. This is owned by the state. And nothing is being done to clean it up. And you're holding our small demo landfills to a higher standard than we're holding ourselves. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. House File 3715 is laid over. I think we have a couple minutes if the two FFA officers want to come down.
Is that what it was?
Brandy Plates, I believe, and Anna Plotz. If you could identify yourself, you can go there, Representative Fabian, and get out of your way. We'll give you a couple minutes. We'd all like to get done early so you won't get the whole 15 minutes. But, hey, tell us a little bit about what brought you here today, where you came from, if you live on a farm, what kind of farm your family does or you hope to do. So either one of you go first. Who you are, where you are from, and what you represent.
My name is Anna Plotz. I am from Clements, Minnesota, and I live on a farm there. My family grows sugar beets, soybeans, corn, and so on.
And what county is that in?
Redwood County.
Okay, thank you. And how long has your family been in the farming business?
Fourth generation.
Fourth generation. Cool. You got any brothers or sisters?
I have one older brother and one older sister.
And what year are you in school, and then where are they at?
I am a sophomore.
In college?
No, in high school.
Okay. I knew that. I was just being a smart aleck.
My sister is currently out at SDSU majoring in mass communications and in political science. And my brother is married, and they had their first baby, and he is planning on taking over the farm.
Well, what about you? When are you taking over the farm?
I'm thinking more on the line of veterinary science right now.
Cool. Okay, Representative Torkelson.
You may not have heard Redwood County.
I did, actually.
I just wanted to make sure that was emphasized, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Not only do sugar beets grow up in Representative Keel's district, but they grow in Representative Torkelson's district. Well, thank you for being here. Could you identify yourself for the record?
I'm Brandy Plates, and I'm part of the Springfield FFA chapter, and I'm currently the officer at large on our chapter team.
What county? How many generations? Or do you live in town?
I live in the country on a farm, and I live in Cottonwood County, and it is the third generation farm.
Okay, what do you farm?
I farm corn and soybeans.
Cool. Any brothers or sisters?
Yes, I have an older brother, an older sister, and another older sister.
And who's involved in the farming operations in your family?
My brother is, he helps us on the farm, and my sister currently is a senior in high school, and she is going to SDSU to be an ag teacher.
Cool. Well, thank you all. Let's give them all a round of applause. Thanks, ladies. We're adjourned for the weekend.
Thank you.